The Second Amendment stands as perhaps America's most contentious constitutional provision. When firearms ownership is both widespread and divisive, understanding the legal framework becomes essential. With approximately 230 to 300 million privately owned firearms in America, roughly matching or exceeding the adult population, this isn't merely an academic debate. About 34% of American adults personally own firearms, with ownership rates varying dramatically by region. Above 65% in Wyoming and Montana, but only around 15% in states like New Jersey. This geographic distribution reflects deeper cultural and historical patterns that have shaped American firearms law since the nation's founding. The technical realities of firearms often get lost in emotional debates. Handguns, comprising about 80% of weapons used in crimes, remain overwhelmingly chosen by American society for lawful self-defense, as the Supreme Court noted in Heller. Meanwhile, rifles, despite their capabilities and controversial status in public discourse, appear in only 1.3% of violent crimes. This disconnect between perception and reality has profound implications for both policy and constitutional interpretation. How can we craft effective legislation when the technical realities often differ dramatically from public understanding? The philosophical foundations of arms rights extend back millennia. Ancient Chinese texts show contrasting views. Confucius emphasized proper training before arming citizens, while Taoist writings advocated making people equal by arming them to ensure justice. In Greece, Plato and Aristotle both recognized the connection between arms possession and political power, though with opposite conclusions. Plato favored centralized weapon control, while Aristotle linked arms bearing with self-government, identifying disarmament as a tactic of tyrants. Roman law provided direct precedence for modern self-defense rights. Cicero described self-defense as not written but born with us, arguing that laws are silent when arms are raised, and every means of securing our safety is honorable when facing danger. The Corpus Juris Civilis later codified that it is permissible to repel force by force, and this right is conferred by nature. These weren't merely academic concepts, they profoundly influenced the framers, who studied classical history extensively when crafting the Second Amendment. The English tradition provided the foundation for American constitutional thinking. The 1689 English Bill of Rights established that subjects which are Protestants may have arms for their defense, while Blackstone's commentaries described this right as an auxiliary right protecting security, liberty, and property, a public allowance under due restrictions of the natural right of resistance and self-preservation. Colonial America expanded these traditions. Most colonies required citizens to own firearms, beginning with Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1631. By 1645, Massachusetts mandated all inhabitants to have arms in their houses fit for service. Some colonies even required weapons at church services. The American Revolution began when British forces attempted to disarm colonists. On April 19, 1775, 700 British redcoats marched to seize American arms at Lexington and Concord. At Lexington Green, Major Pitcairn demanded, "Disperse, you rebels! Damn you! Throw down your arms and disperse!" Later, General Gage in Boston offered to let Bostonians leave town if they surrendered their weapons. After collecting 2,674 guns, he broke his promise, claiming many arms remained hidden. During constitutional ratification debates, anti-federalists feared potential disarmament. Patrick Henry warned that without explicit protections, citizens would be defenseless against tyranny. In response, James Madison proposed what became the Second Amendment, which, after revisions, read, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." 10 days later, Tench Cox published an analysis explaining that the amendment confirmed people's right to keep and bear their private arms against potential tyranny. The 1792 Militia Act required every free, able-bodied white male citizen between 18 and 45 to provide himself with firearms and necessary equipment. St. George Tucker's influential 1803 legal commentaries emphasized that the American right existed without any qualification as to their condition or degree, unlike Britain, where game laws effectively disarmed most people. After the Civil War, Southern states enacted black codes prohibiting freed slaves from possessing firearms. Florida's 1865 Act provided that it shall not be lawful for any Negro, mulatto, or other person of color to own, use, or keep in his possession or under his control any bowie knife, dirk, sword, firearms, or ammunition of any kind. The Ku Klux Klan's initial tactic was often to forcibly disarm blacks, making subsequent intimidation easier. Congress responded with the 14th Amendment and civil rights legislation explicitly protecting the constitutional right to bear arms. However, the Supreme Court's 1875 Cruikshank decision severely limited federal protection of these rights, effectively leaving freed slaves at the mercy of hostile state governments and private violence. The 20th century brought significant federal regulation. The National Firearms Act of 1934 created a tax and registration scheme for gangster weapons. The Gun Control Act of 1968 prohibited certain categories of people from possessing firearms. The 1990s saw the Brady Act requiring background checks and the assault weapons ban, followed by significant political backlash. A scholarly renaissance beginning in the 1970s transformed Second Amendment understanding. What was once viewed as merely a collective right tied to militia service emerged as a legitimate field of constitutional inquiry, with even liberal scholars eventually endorsing the individual rights interpretation. This culminated in District of Columbia v. Heller, 2008, where the court held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess firearms and use them for self-defense at home. Justice Scalia's majority opinion analyzed English common law, colonial practice, and founding-era sources. In McDonald v. City of Chicago, 2010, the court extended this protection against state and local governments through the 14th Amendment. These landmark decisions established that the right to keep and bear arms applies at all government levels. However, they left crucial questions unanswered. What scrutiny level applies to gun regulations? Does the right extend beyond the home? What restrictions remain constitutional? This ambiguity continues driving ongoing litigation. Courts struggle to develop a coherent framework for evaluating gun regulations. Some adopt a two-step inquiry that determines whether the restricted activity falls within Second Amendment protection before applying appropriate scrutiny. Others propose a substantial burden test similar to abortion jurisprudence. These methodological debates reflect deeper questions about constitutional interpretation. Should Second Amendment cases be analyzed through originalism or follow a more living constitutionalist approach? How should individual rights balance against public safety concerns? The debate intersects with questions about race, gender, and vulnerability. Gun control has historically been used to disarm marginalized communities. Some argue that strict gun control disproportionately impacts vulnerable populations with the greatest need for self-defense, including women, the elderly, the disabled, and LGBT individuals facing hate crimes. The Second Amendment's evolution from philosophical roots through revolutionary struggle to modern jurisprudence shows that rights evolve through democratic engagement. In a nation where firearms represent both liberty and tragedy, understanding this legal landscape becomes an essential civic responsibility.